Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, award-winning author and historian Kevin Kokemore talks about how the real first Thanksgiving happened in Florida.
When people think of Thanksgiving as like a turkey or a ham or something, you know, that's really not what natives would have brought to the table at all. So in Northeast Florida, you know, probably would have been venison, probably would have been fish, probably would have been something from the coastline.
We'll discuss the age of glamorous nightclubs in Miami Beach.
Like all dazzling moments, it faded too quickly, undermined by its own gold rush mentality and the appearance of a new competitor against which nightclubs had few options.
And we'll visit the historically black American beach. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
So fill your plate and fill your drink and fill this house with family, the kind of love that all these years can't wash away. 'Cause the older that I get, I see the life is short and bittersweet. Thank God for this Thanksgiving Day.
Tradition holds that the first Thanksgiving was celebrated in 1621 as English pilgrims at Plymouth Plantation in Massachusetts shared a bountiful harvest with their Native American neighbors. The first Thanksgiving in North America actually took place in Florida. 55 years before the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, Spanish colonists in St. Augustine shared a feast of Thanksgiving with Native Americans. The traditional story of the first Thanksgiving in 1621 is based upon limited information from pilgrims Edward Winslow and William Bradford. Kevin Kokemore is author of the award-winning book La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories.
That's what I think was most surprising to me when I first started looking into the Pilgrim Plymouth version, is that the sources are still more than the sources that you get from the St. Augustine. The sources that you get from St. Augustine is not even an entire sentence. It doesn't get a whole lot less than that. But the surprising part was that I think from Bradford and Winslow's accounts of Plymouth, you know, collectively, their experiences were no more than a few sentences. So yeah, we are talking about, in both cases, traditions that, you know, we can make a lot of really educated guesses about what happened, but the sources are pretty scarce for both of them.
Florida historian Michael Gannon identified September 8, 1565 as the date of the real first Thanksgiving in his 1965 book, The Cross in the Sand. That was the day that Don Pedro Menendez de Avilés and his crew first landed in St. Augustine. Kevin Kokemore points out that Menendez hosted other Thanksgiving feasts on Our Lady's Day, St. Matthew's Day, and All Saints' Day.
I agreed with him in that there were several, because there were several really important sort of sub-stories to the founding of St. Augustine. There was thanks that had to be given for literally making it alive across the Atlantic. There was thanks for establishing St. Augustine. And then there were the thanks that were given for the several massacres. And so there was only one in which I think Grijalva basically says, who is the friar that's there with him, who is the Catholic priest that's there with him, that there's one in particular, and that's the September one, where he basically says, Menendez de Avilés gives thanks and feeds the natives. And so there are several moments when the Spaniards stop to give thanks, but there's really only one source that says he had dinner and he dined with the natives, right? So Yeah, that's why he went with that a date, and that seems pretty accurate. And again, I mean, that's really all we have is that one sentence.
Kevin Kokomore begins his book, La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories, by building upon Michael Gannon's challenging of the first Thanksgiving narrative. From there, Kokomore demonstrates that Spanish, non-English, and non-Protestant people had a much greater impact on the development of America than what they have been previously given credit for.
The idea of La Florida is not just that it is the peninsula that we now know as the state of Florida, right? And in the earliest years of La Florida, it was Spain's claim to most of North America. And so I try to be very careful in the introduction to sort of describe all of this as this is not a triumphant tale of Catholicism. This is not basically, you know, neo-colonialist, you know, the Spanish basically made North America what it is. I wasn't trying to bring that interpretation to it at all. But the Spanish, their attempt at colonization, their unsuccessful attempts at colonization, and then their successful endeavors, beginning with St. Augustine, it impacted early American history in a lot of really important ways. The colonization leads to the missions in the Southeast. It leads to the disease, and it leads to the exploitation of Native peoples, which really ushers in the transformation of the Southeast, is an example. The food waste tradition, which I try to think of as kind of a little bit lighter than the quote-unquote transformation of the Native South. The foodways traditions, I think, are also surprisingly Spanish. Oranges in Florida, cattle in the Southeast, pigs in the Southeast. I even argue about barbecue in the Southeast. All has, in one way or another, been influenced by the Spanish attempts to colonize the Southeast. So the Catholic part of that is a very important part of that story. It is the reason why Spaniards were in the Caribbean. It is an important reason why they established St. Augustine and the missions that followed. And so when I talk about the first Thanksgiving, it's really, it really shows this deep Catholic connection to the settling of, or the attempt to settle, Florida. And it is one of the most important driving factors in the early colonization. And that's something that would surprise most people because, again, and this is the larger idea of the book, is that when most people think of early American history and when most people think of the early religious history of the country, they think Protestant, not Catholic. And so the first Thanksgiving I use as an introduction because it sort of busts that myth a little.
The 1619 Project identifies that year as the starting point for American slavery and re-examines the long-term effects of slavery. Kokomore points out that Spanish slaves had been in Florida throughout the previous century.
The Thanksgiving tradition is the way I started it out, and 1619 is the way I actually wrapped up the book, because one of the most important legacies in early American history is that date in which enslaved people were sold in the English colonies. And if you wanted to complicate that, that is absolutely objectively true when it came to the English colonies. But Florida had already been in existence for generations, and slavery in Florida had already been in existence for generations. And in a lot of ways, it was unique. The Spanish crown owned people in a way that the English government didn't. The Catholic Church treated enslaved people differently than, say, the church is the Anglican Church in Virginia or in South Carolina. So there are differences, but there's also a lot of really important similarities. Slavery in Florida was chattel slavery. It treated people as property. That existed in Florida. And it wasn't just a native slavery. It was the Atlantic slave trade. And so it was the same Atlantic slave trade that would remake and that would influence the development of the American Southeast. It really has a legacy in Florida that predates 1619 by, I mean, in some cases, you could argue an entire century. In fact, one of the most important suggestions that I make at several points in the book is that from the baptismal records that you get out of St. Augustine, Spaniards are notorious bureaucrats, and they keep these really elaborate baptismal records to make sure that Catholic blood stays pure, I guess you could say. And what that demonstrates are marriages of Native people, marriages of enslaved people, the births of Native people, the births of enslaved people. And what we actually have in the early 17th century are basically enslaved African families in Florida having children. And so not only do I suggest that slavery in Florida predates Virginia and 1619, it actually predates Virginia, right? So you have the enslaved history of North America is actually, I guess you could say, technically earlier than the English history of North America. And that's a pretty stunning addition to early American history.
Kevin Cocamore earned the Charlton Tebow Book Award for his important documentation of Spanish influences on early American development, a topic largely ignored until now.
Everything has flowed from the Pilgrims and from New England. It's just such an American story. It's Protestant. It is sort of the homogenous sort of idea of what makes Americans, is this triumphant story of Pilgrims. I mean, the Pilgrim story in a lot of ways is even more popular than the Jamestown story. I mean, when people think of the early English settlements that make the United States of America, a lot of people, you know, without thinking twice, would point to Plymouth and point to Pilgrim heritage as sort of like the first real American heritage. And that's just been ingrained in our popular culture. It's just been ingrained in our popular history. And, you know, it's not that that's not important, but that is only a part of the story of a very complicated North America. And so when you think of American history, you just don't think of a Catholic history. You don't think of a Spanish history. That's not what you've been taught in grade school. That's not what you've been taught basically in popular culture and in movies. It just sort of flowed with this. It is the dominant narrative of the country. And again, it's not that it's entirely wrong, but it is oversimplifying things to a great deal.
We can't talk about Thanksgiving without discussing the menu. It's questionable whether or not the modern Thanksgiving meal of turkey, stuffing, and cranberry sauce is based on historical fact. Kevin Cocamore speculates about what would have been served at the real first Thanksgiving in St. Augustine.
So you got to think of what Spaniards would have had on hand and what the natives would have had on hand. So, you know, wild fowl probably would have been there. We think if it's the Southeast, and this is probably the same with the Northeast, actually. When people think of Thanksgiving as like a turkey or a ham or something, you know, that's really not what natives would have brought to the table at all. So in Northeast Florida, you know, probably would have been venison, probably would have been fish, probably would have been something from the coastline. That's what they would have offered if they had brought anything at all. And what the Spaniards would have offered would have been, you know, this really sort of classic Spanish bean soup, I would imagine. A lot of cured, heavily salted ham, garbanzo beans. It would have been brothy, probably extremely salty. Probably would have washed it down with quite a bit of wine. You know, the Spaniards would have had that on board as well. And something sweet, I think some people have suggested maybe honey, maybe biscuits, something made with flour. So it definitely would not have looked like the Thanksgiving that we have now. Absolutely not. It would have been pretty unimpressive, actually.
I think I'll stick with turkey this year. Kevin Cocamore is author of the book La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories. We discussed the real first Thanksgiving held in 1565 in St. Augustine, 56 years before the Pilgrim celebration. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture. Watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
At the Copa, Copacabana, the hottest spot north of Havana. At the Copa, Copacabana, music and passion were always the fashion at the Copa.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, following World War II, people were in a mood to celebrate, and Miami Beach was ready to accommodate them with an active nightclub scene.
Yes, they were. Not everyone who is published in the Florida Historical Quarterly is an academic historian. One of the more interesting articles was submitted by an associate professor in public administration at Florida International University, Keith D. Revel. His article, The Rise and Fall of Copa City, 1944 to 1957, appeared in the spring 2017 issue of the Quarterly. It explores the life of the city's most glamorous era of nightclubs and high-end entertainment. Copa City, Revel tells us, was the product of a dazzling moment in the history of Miami Beach as a world-class tourist destination. Like all dazzling moments, it faded too quickly, undermined by its own gold rush mentality and the appearance of a new competitor against which nightclubs had few options. Revel uses Copa City to illuminate the role of nightlife in the rapid evolution of Miami Beach as a tourist city. The nightery, as nightclubs were called in the trade, lured nationally and internationally known entertainers to perform on its stage before succumbing to unmanageable debt and the next form of competition. Copa City was a glamorous and important moment in the tourism history of Miami Beach.
And even in the mid-20th century, Miami Beach nightclubs were ready to serve diverse audiences.
They were. In his 1981 book on New York nightlife, Louis A. Ehrenberg argued that that city's nightclubs facilitated the transition from the staid mores of Victorian gentility by creating new styles of consumption, sexual expression, and social interaction. Nightclubs, he says, transformed the deviant, disreputable elements of Prohibition-era entertainment into safe but exciting fare for an increasingly large urban market, the patrons of which found their way to Miami in the annual tourist season. Miami nightclubs were contested spaces that battled against local authorities to allow behaviors that crossed color lines as entertainers explored the rhythms and motifs of Afro-Caribbean and Cuban music. As Julio Capo Jr. notes in his award-winning book, Welcome to Fairyland, nightclubs and other entertainment venues crossed gender and racial boundaries seemingly with little interference from authorities, at least during tourist season. Miami Beach, historians agree, emerged as an adult playground without the family theme parks and roadside attractions that brought more sedate tourists to Central Florida. Tourists flocking to Miami came for an adventure. They came to be naughty. Chief among the nightclubs of post-World War II Miami Beach, Copa City stood out for its sheer audacity in everything from its sweeping modern construction, featured on the cover image of the Quarterly, to its high-dollar entertainment. Fulfilling its vision of glamour laid the foundation for its downfall.
What do you mean? Did Copa City spend more on its image than it could generate in income?
Yeah, Revel analyzes Copa City and the nightclub era to make three related arguments. First, nightlife existed in a defined geography of glamour that drew tourists to Miami Beach. Secondly, he uses the story of Murray Weiner and his club Copa City to illustrate the competition between nightclubs that pushed owners to take enormous financial risks and produced a gold rush mentality that ended in collapse. Finally, he argues, the movement from the nightclub district to the cloistered spaces of glamorous hotels ended the reign of niteries that ushered in a new era of entertainment. Niteries concentrated in two key areas of South Beach. On the ocean side, visitors found the 5 o'clock Club, the El Chico Club, Wits Inn, Boscia's Villa Venice, and Bill Jordan's Bar of Music. On the bay side stood the largest and most noteworthy venues, the Beachcomber, Copacabana, Kitty Davis's Airport, later Airliner, and Mother Kelly's. Among other venues scattered around the area were the Paddock Club and the Royal Palm Club. Revel notes that in 1940, with a population of slightly more than 28,000, Miami Beach was home to more than a dozen niteries. In the post-war era, nightclub owners shelled out large sums of money to attract nationally known entertainers to perform in their clubs, including Milton Berle, Maurice Chevalier, Sophie Tucker, Lena Horne, Louis Armstrong, Josephine Baker, and Cab Calloway. Milton Berle was offered $20,000 to play the Copacabana. The bidding war for performers was most vigorous between the owner of the Beachcomber and winer of the Copacabana, later Copa City.
And Miami Beach's glamorous nightclub era continued well into the 1950s, right?
It did. Murray Weiner arrived in Miami Beach in 1944 from Coney Island, New York, where he learned the nightery trade. In a sleight of hand, using the good credit of his partner, he purchased the Monte Carlo for $96,000, renamed it the Copacabana, and bought out his partner. He gave the Copacabana a $100,000 facelift and joined the talent war. On June 7, 1948, a fire destroyed the Copacabana. Standing in the ashes, Weiner voiced the possibility of attracting the foremost modernist architect, Norman Bel Geddes, the so-called Grand Master of Modernism, to design a new nightclub. Almost like something imagined in Hollywood, Bel Geddes agreed. After 7 months of planning and construction, Copa City opened in December 1948, just in time for the tourist season. With movable interior walls and no interior columns to obstruct patron views, Copa City could accommodate 150 to 800 patrons for dinner, dancing, and performances. The sweeping entrance had no neon lighting. Its plain exterior was elegance personified. Despite its popularity, though, the overwhelming debt incurred in constructing the new club, Del Geddes was never paid for his work, and the cost associated with the escalating talent wars, Copa City closed its doors only months later. Until his untimely death in 1957 at age 40, Weiner continued to pursue his Copa City dream, opening and closing the club several times. After his death, the elegant building hosted a number of less-than-elegant tenants. At the time of the publication of the article, it was a storage facility. Weiner and Copa City were fighting an uphill battle in the early 1950s as Miami Beach engaged in a new form of tourism, the rise of self-contained beach hotels. Offering restaurants, pools, and beach access, shops, and nightclub venues, hotels like the Fontainebleau and the Eden Rock promised everything without leaving the hotel grounds. The era of the Miami Beach nightclub had come to an end.
It sounds like a fun era to participate in. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker has this look at a children's book about the historically Black American beach.
As a girl, Mavine Betch loved the beach. She loved the whoosh of its waves, its blue sky stretching to forever, and the creatures swimming in its tangy sea. But Mavine couldn't go to just any beach. Because of her skin, silken and butter brown, she couldn't eat in most restaurants or visit most bathrooms. There was even a rope in the ocean. One side said colored, the other white. Something must be done, her great-grandfather said. And so Mr. Abraham Lincoln Lewis bought a beach. It was an ocean paradise where his family and other Black people could swim, picnic, and build sandcastles. He believed that a beach should be open to everyone.
That was author Heidi Tylene King reading from her award-winning picture book, Saving American Beach, the biography of African-American environmentalist Mavine Betch. illustrated by Caldecott honoree Equa Holmes, Saving American Beach tells the story of Mauveen Betch, an African-American opera singer turned environmentalist who became known as the Beach Lady.
So Mauveen Betch, I think a lot of people, if you do know her as the Beach Lady. But she grew up in a very wealthy African-American family in Jacksonville. And her great-grandfather actually, at one time, was one of the richest, wealthiest African-Americans. So they couldn't go to the beach, which is crazy. So he decided to do something about that. And so he actually bought a beach. The beach was named American Beach, and it was a place where he wanted African-Americans to be able to go for relaxation without discrimination. So all of the celebrities of the day went to American Beach. But there are people who remember the Betch family arriving in limousines for their summer vacation as well. And that was Mauveen's family. She went to Oberlin College, became a well-respected, world-renowned opera singer. And when her mother was very sick, she returned to Florida to care for her. And then when her mother died, she stayed.
After returning to Florida, Mauveen Betch dedicated her life to protecting the environment. She spent the rest of her days educating people about Black history and the environmental importance of American Beach, a place she considered sacred.
She was a staunch environmentalist, and she well may have been one of the very first African-American women environmentalists. So she was very much one and the same with the beach. She stayed there, and she really advocated for the beach, and she would give tours, and she would really talk to anybody who would listen about why that beach was so special. And she just continued doing that, even when people weren't listening, when it wasn't a big deal to be environmentally friendly or to preserve places for all people. So I think that she really just kept going when so many people would have given up.
In 2002, American Beach was added to the National Register of Historic Places. Mauveen Betch, lovingly called the Beach Lady, passed away in 2005 at the age of 70. Her ashes were scattered in the ocean off of American Beach and on the high dunes she successfully fought to protect. She was posthumously honored as an unsung hero of compassion by the Dalai Lama. She's remembered today for her contributions to the environmental movement and for fighting for diversity and inclusion in public spaces. In 2014, American Beach Museum opened its doors, bringing one of Mauveen's dreams to life. Heidi Tylene King.
Florida has a lot of development on its beaches. There aren't very many left like American Beach that are as pristine. And I think the Beach Lady recognized that and really did march in Tallahassee. And she used her body and art as a way to protest what was going on.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a very happy Thanksgiving. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.